funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How many meals in America go uneaten? Well, it might seem surprising, given our national struggles with overweight and obesity. We actually throw out nearly as much food as we consume in this country, wasting not only enough calories in a year to nourish 1.7 billion hungry people, but millions of gallons of fuel to grow, transport, and prepare food that ends up in the trash. Jonathan Bloom is a freelance journalist who also blogs at wastedfood.com. He writes about our addiction to profligate food production in his new book, American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Great to be here.
So how much food does the average American waste every year?
It's just about the average body weight of most Americans, 197 pounds per year.
Wow. You know, my first thought when I read the book was, well, that doesn't happen in my house. But then reading on, I realized a lot of it's thrown out before it ever gets to my kitchen.
Yeah, that's the per capita waste. So it's not necessarily the weight that you throw out personally in your homes, but if you factor in the number of people in the country and all the food that is thrown out throughout the food chain.
So let's start with farms. It would seem that producers would want to sell every single thing that comes out of the ground, but market conditions don't always make that feasible.
Yeah, it's a bit sad what happens. A lot of farmers will grow in excess knowing that they're not going to harvest all of it, just sort of as an insurance policy. And that's a policy that came from the Secretary of Agriculture in the 70s, the idea that we just need to grow from fence row to fence row. So some of it is that caution and making sure that we definitely have enough, but then also the market conditions, like if the prices for a certain good don't justify harvesting it, then they just walk on by. And so those are called walk-bys. Hmm. And I know farmers don't like to see that happen. I mean, they don't grow food to plow it under, but that's a sad reality of life in today's agriculture.
And then I guess there's the question as to whether you're going to pick mechanically or by hand, and that can make a difference?
Certainly. Whenever you have to hire migrant workers, it's difficult. It's expensive, and these days it's fairly hard to find migrant workers post 9/11. There are many issues with coming in and out of the country, as I'm sure your listeners are aware of. So that adds another challenge.
So you get it out of the fields, and then there's the journey from farm to market, which can cause a lot of damage, and there's some spoilage along the way.
Yeah, we've made tremendous strides in keeping things fresh over the journey, but the average food item travels 1,500 miles from where it's grown to where it's consumed. So there's plenty of room for winnowing throughout that process. And there are so many hands that touch it, and there are many opportunities for it to go for naught.
And sometimes it's just an issue of something isn't big enough. You know, there's a sort of a discount grocery store in my neighborhood, and the food there is great, the produce is great, but the apples are the size of like a fist instead of your head, which is different from the fancy grocery store just up the street.
Yeah, well, that's a particular pet peeve of mine, that the idea that food has to look perfect for it to be edible. And I think that's a recent development brought on by the advent of all these food shows that we have and the cooking magazines. So we want our food to not only taste great, but to look beautiful. So as a result of that, any fruits or vegetables that don't look just right and don't look the part, whether it's the wrong shape or size or it might have a tiny blemish, those are going to be thrown out, mostly at the supermarket level, but so many of those fruits and vegetables aren't even picked or tossed before they get to supermarkets.
Yeah, I was really amazed to read, you have something in here about cucumbers, that if they happen to be bent, they can't be packaged properly, and so they're just useless. They're perfectly good. There's not a blemish on them, but they're not the right sort of straight shape that we've come to expect.
Yeah, and the same thing happens with bananas that are straight. The opposite problem. But basically, growers they sell their produce by the box. And if you have a curved cucumber, you can't fit the right number in a box. So just the way that we do business sometimes leads to waste. And with a product like cucumber that's fairly cheap, people don't think twice about that. And I think people would be amazed at the loss rate in a cucumber sorting facility.
One of the things you did, I guess, as part of research for this, is that you worked in a supermarket. Can you talk about some of the things that you witnessed while you were there?
Sure. And more than just witnessing it, I actually took part in throwing away a lot of the food, unfortunately. And that's just a cost of doing business for the supermarket industry. So as you said, I worked in the produce department, and a big part of the waste there came from the bagged produce, bagged lettuce and cut fruit, that kind of thing. So anything with the use-by or sell-by date obviously gets pulled. And the sell-by date in particular was pretty annoying because, you know, you'd see this stuff, and it was perfectly edible at that time, but you couldn't sell it. And this store was just throwing it into the garbage. So I understand that stores aren't going to sell that stuff, but at the same time, it's anything but trash. So that's where the idea of having a food recovery group or a nonprofit come in and collect that food, that's where there's room for that.
That seems like the perfect solution, but it can be really, I guess, complicated to orchestrate something like that.
Yeah, you'd be amazed. It's really not that difficult at the supermarket level. We were able to actually implement it at the store I worked. I basically just put two people in touch and let them work it out. And they would come every other day and collect the goods that were edible but not sellable. And to be honest, it was actually easier for the store because it was quicker to just put the culled fruit and vegetables into the walk-in cooler than to bring it all the way out to the dumpster. Now, where you run into a little difficulty is at restaurants where they're closing late at night, and then they have all this food that they have to refrigerate. And there's obviously more perishable foods when you're talking about proteins and entrees like that. And no food recovery groups are going to come by at midnight to pick that up. So they have to chill it and cover it for the next day.
How open are most grocery stores to the idea of people coming in and sort of gleaning what is still good but can't be sold?
Well, the majority of stores do give some of their extra food or the stuff that I call edible but not sellable. They do give that to nonprofits. The issue there is what they give. So, you know, 95% of the stores give their old bread, but that's quite frankly just not something that food banks need as much as proteins and fresh fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. So the things that are more perishable, stores tend to be a bit more squeamish about donating. And I think primarily it's from liability fears. But what I've found is that they're unfounded in that there's a Good Samaritan law, a federal act, that protects donors from liability when they give stuff that in good faith they deem to be edible.
Why is it so confusing to use those use-by, sell-by, best-by dates? I mean, how come that's not standardized by now so we all know what in the world they're talking about?
Yeah, that is a real tricky topic, isn't it? Well, so the sell-by date is aimed at the stores, so it's almost as if we shouldn't see that. But we do, and so it's confusing. So it would be better if we had closed dating instead of open dating, where meaning we didn't see that sell-by date, and stores have different methods that they can use to communicate when things can be pulled, like the colored tabs on the top of a bag of bread. But there are so many different terms that it does get confusing, and I even get confused, and I study this stuff. So, I mean, I think the best way of thinking of it would be that sell-by date, that gives you about 7 days after that to bring the food home and eat it in peak freshness. And then after that, you've got the best before or best by, and that's a little bit more stringent, but it's mostly a guide on when something's going to have it that optimal taste. And then use by is the most stringent, and you should probably pay some attention to it, but I would definitely advise to take it with a grain of salt to make sure that the item is bad, because there is a lot of caution built into those dates.
Yeah, can we trust our taste buds to know if something is spoiled to the extent that it's bad for us, as opposed to maybe not being as crispy as we wanted it to be?
Yeah, I think we can. I have faith in you and the listeners out there to know when something is good or isn't good. And for some people who may be a little bit unsure whether they'll be able to tell, I think if you've ever smelled bad milk, you'll know. And just have faith in your sense of smell. And if you can't figure it out, maybe take a little taste. And I'm pretty sure that you'll know.
Of course, you always have to have somebody else smell bad milk, don't you? You never fully do trust yourself. Isn't this bad?
Yeah, you want to get that second opinion a lot of times, don't you?
Another thing that grocery stores do that ends up wasting a lot of stuff is the buy one, get one free thing. Like if I buy a jar of mayonnaise, I'm not likely to need another one for 6 months. I don't need two.
No, most people don't. I kind of hope you don't. But a lot of times we're induced into buying too much and induced into waste just by those deals. So in the UK, they've really made a big initiative to try and stop doing that, and the supermarkets are on board. Unfortunately, that isn't really the case yet here, but hopefully we will we'll get supermarkets to play along.
What about the big box grocery stores? You know, people belong to Sam's Club or Costco or one of those places, and the portions and the boxes don't look so gigantic when you're in a room with 50-foot ceilings, but then you get home and you end up having overbought most of the time.
Yeah, well, I don't shop at those kind of places, and so I have to say, even when I'm in the store, they do look gigantic, mm-hmm. but I could imagine how you'd get used to it after a while. But I visited a few for the book and doing research, and it was fairly astounding, just the amount of some of the packages, like a 5-pound tub of mayonnaise, or if you want a half gallon of milk, you know, that's not possible. There are 3 half gallons attached, sort of taped together, which kind of defeats the purpose of getting a half gallon. So, I mean, they're certainly handy if you're buying non-perishable items or if you have a huge family. But I would definitely advise people to just be careful in buying perishables there.
Yeah, what is funny about those places is that most people join thinking, well, I'm doing this to save money, but if you throw away 2/3 of what you've paid for, then you've wasted money.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, and a lot of times we're very deal-oriented when we go to the supermarket, but, I mean, I find if you don't even think about coupons or sales and just buy what you're going to buy, and if it happens to be on sale, then that's a bonus. I think you'd do just as well.
So you talk about being careful about perishables. I hate to even ask this question. Are processed foods somehow less wasteful than fresh foods?
Well, with processed foods, it's a little bit different. Whole foods tend to last longer, so anything that's processed in any way, whether it's a product like Spam or right on down the line to simply like cut fruit. Anything that's been altered is going to decompose quicker.
So we're not saving anything by buying something that's already pre-made for us?
Well, it just depends on your habits. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times what happens with convenience foods or the ready-to-eat foods is that we'll have bought fresh foods in our refrigerator, and we'll have the best intentions of cooking a fresh meal, but our lifestyles are so busy these days that we don't necessarily have time to cook it. So then on the way home from work, when we get out at 6 or 7, we'll stop off and grab some pre-made food. So that convenience food sometimes leads to waste at home.
Jonathan Bloom is my guest. He's a freelance journalist who blogs at wastedfood.com. His new book is called American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is freelance journalist Jonathan Bloom. He blogs at wastedfood.com. His new book is called American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It. You can be part of the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Jonathan, let's talk about restaurants. For starters, how do they compare meals in restaurants calorically with what we might make at home?
Yeah, we tend to eat much more when we are out at restaurants, both in terms of the quantity because of the portion sizes, but also because of the food that is served and how it's cooked, so it's not usually as healthy. The portions are what I focus on more. The nutrition stuff gets into some other topics. But I think that the portions we receive at restaurants have really changed how we think about what is normal to eat and have really infiltrated our thinking. And when we're at home, we tend to serve more these days because of it.
So if you're served a pound of pasta at whatever macaroni grill, you think that's what you're supposed to eat at home?
Yeah, it's the new normal. Mm-hmm. And that combined with the larger plates that most of us have these days, that puts us in a bad spot, and in that we're constantly being forced to choose between wasting food or overeating. So my point on that would be to try and save your leftovers, but unfortunately not everyone could do that. Sometimes you're maybe out for the night or traveling, and some people just don't like leftovers. So hopefully what I'd like to see is restaurants give diners more choice.
So if you think you can only eat a third of what they serve, you could order that and pay for that.
Yeah, exactly. And whether it's smaller portions for less money or sharing an entree with your dining partner, there are a number of strategies that you could employ. But the one chain that I always like to highlight is TGI Friday. They're actually doing that where they're serving less food for lower prices, and they call it the right portion, right price menu.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. You guys are just talking about the reason that I called in. I worked in the restaurant industry for years and years and years, and it always, you know, I don't want to be too dramatic, but it just disgusted me with the huge portions that were served, particularly in places like steakhouses and things like that. And I was always amazed at how the average diner expected huge portions of food for what they were paying, and rarely did anyone even come close to finishing what was on their plate. And going out to eat on occasion with my family, we were noticing the same thing. So my wife and I just decided at a certain point that we were going to just start eating one entree and splitting it, because we always thought, well, heck, we can always order more food if we need it, as opposed to just having it sitting there on the plate so it's wasted and rotting. And, I mean, two great things came out of that. Actually, three. We saved money right off the bat. We weren't wasting as much food, and in all honesty, by eating half of an entree, for our health, it was much, much better, because we obviously weren't trying to eat more calories just because it was something we felt like we needed to since we had paid for it.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Tim. Are most people, our servers and things, are they surprised by this? Do they give you a weird look, or are they fine with it?
Oh, no, they hate it. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, the restaurants, they don't like it when that happens, and in a lot of cases, we have run into, there is a sharing fee that they have actually begun to implement in some of these places. And that's a way for them to try, of course, to recoup some of the money that they're losing as a result of that. But, you know, I'm a critical care nurse specialist, and so I see the result in cardiovascular ICUs all the time, in my personal opinion, of the extent with which this, you know, this overeating, this gluttonous type of approach to the way that we feed ourselves is ultimately, you know, ending up in really bad shape. And,
yep.
And so I'm glad to hear that your guest is really working hard to fix this.
I really appreciate your call, Tim. Thank you so much. Jonathan, have you experienced the same thing, that people give you kind of the gimlet eye when you try to order less than the regular portion?
I try not to pay attention to it, to be quite honest. But, no, I do understand that. I have experienced it. But I think the idea of a sharing fee is kind of ridiculous. You know, if that's the case, then... And I would say, how about restaurants serving a reasonable portion? I mean, if you're bringing people to resort to sharing entrees, then something's wrong.
I guess it is great that at least there's no stigma, as far as I can tell, to taking your food home now, whereas you used to have to pretend it was for the dog and it never was. Everybody, you're sort of expected to ask for a box, right?
I think we're almost there. I think we're definitely getting to a point where leftovers are acceptable and widespread. I spoke with Alice Waters from Chez Panisse, and that's one of the nicer restaurants in the country, and she said that she used to really look down on people taking their food home, but now she does it herself. So that's a pretty good bellwether.
You write about a really interesting college cafeteria in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I was hoping you'd bring up Reed College. So this is a place near and dear to my heart just because I find it fascinating. There are students there who are called scroungers who opt not to pay for a meal plan. And instead, they subsist off eating the leftovers from their fellow students' plates. And it's gotten to the point where it's very accepted and it's institutionalized, where they have a specific couple tables that they stand at. And basically, people know to offer their leftovers to the scroungers, and they're happy to eat the half eaten sandwiches, and I went out there and scrounged with them, and I was pretty surprised, and there were some leftovers that were pretty enticing.
You know, you have a kind of a lengthy description of this process, and it is sort of formalized, and there's, you know, rules about, you know, if someone knows that they're sick, they won't share. But did it strike you, was it hard to get over the idea of taking somebody else's half-eaten sandwich, a stranger, not a friend or a family member?
Well, it's sort of like a trust fall. You just kind of close your eyes and jump. And it worked out. I mean, everyone I spoke with there said that they had never gotten sick from this. And in fact, they claimed the opposite, that it made their immune systems more robust. So I don't know. I mean, I've had one experience with it, and I was fine. And I haven't heard of any people who really got sick from it. So it's certainly not something that's going to work in mainstream society, but I think it's really interesting. It gets us to think about how much excess there is out there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Cole in Fort Worth. Hi, Cole.
How you doing? Thank you very much for having this discussion. I'm a fourth-year medical student in Fort Worth, Texas right now, and we try to create a healthy food bank for patients that were afflicted by chronic diseases that were really struggling to maintain a sufficient nutritional intake that would kind of keep everything regulated. But what we ran into when we were looking for possible areas for people to donate food, we went to local high schools and found out that half the food that they didn't eat during lunch periods was just thrown in the trash in Texas. And it was just, it broke my heart that that much food was just wasted on a daily basis at our high schools and middle schools just because that's the current policy of how things are.
And
I wanted to see if there's anything that you guys had to comment about that.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Cole. I guess the issue there, Jonathan, is that a lot of school cafeterias, there's not a lot of choice. Kids take what they're given, and then if they don't want to eat the stewed pears, they just dump them.
Yeah, there isn't too much choice. There is a little bit in some programs, but there's a tremendous amount of waste in schools. The younger the students are, the more waste there is. For Cole, I mean, what I would say is that those schools can donate the food as long as it's being served by the staff at the school. Anything that's self-serve can't be donated for food contamination fears. Just, you know, someone might have put the sloppy Joe spoon in the corn and or vice versa and that kind of thing, or someone maybe sneezed on it. So, anyway, hopefully with a little more communication and throwing around the Good Samaritan Act, you might be able to do better if you go back to them.
I was really astonished to read about the food waste at catered affairs. And honestly, it's something I had never given any thought to. But, yeah, you can show up in the first 5 minutes of a catered event, and you can show up at the end, and there's plenty of food, and they have essentially made, 15 to 20% extra over and above the number of people they're expecting.
Yeah, especially with buffets, it's expected that the food never runs out, and that's the American way. It's kind of like Thanksgiving every day. So in order to make that happen, caterers do pack 15 to 20% extra. And the reason they do is because if you're a caterer and you run out of food at an event, that's akin to death. I mean, that's the worst thing that could happen for a caterer. So the ramification is there's a whole lot that's extra, and most often, more times than not, it's thrown out.
Is it common for the staff to be allowed to take the food home if they want it?
Well, I worked at a catering company as part of the research, and that would happen at some of the events. They'd bring it back to the kitchen and let us divvy it up if we wanted, but those were only the events that were pretty close to the kitchen and to the headquarters. So when you're out there, and especially if it's a warm day and in North Carolina and probably in Texas, it usually is, that stuff is then just thrown out on site.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Jonathan Bloom. The new book is called American Wasteland. Let's go next to Mark in Dallas. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Your guest here has a lot of good comments. I would take issue with one point, though. My weekly diet is somewhat dictated by the grocery ads that come out in the newspaper on Wednesday morning. If chicken breast, you know, is two-thirds off, that's probably what I'm going to eat that week. If a lean piece of meat is two-thirds off, I'm probably going to buy that particular week, you know, where the next week it's going to be back up to $9.99 a pound. Strawberries, same thing, 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. You know, they do have freezer bags, which I tend to be somewhat frugal, so I shop for specials like that I can conserve.
Yeah, what about that, Jonathan? Can you be frugal and still not waste food?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think avoiding waste is the epitome of being frugal, mm-hmm. and I'm certainly that way myself. But to get back to Mark's question, you know, I'm not out there advocating that you change your habits if it works for you, and it sounds like it does. But my point with that is I think a lot of people buy things on special that they've never made before, they don't really know what to do with, just to get a good deal, and then it'll often sit there unused. Or maybe you have to buy a certain quantity and you only use half of it. But Mark's dead on in that you can freeze the excess and really make friends with your freezer to reduce waste. So I would definitely advise you keep doing what you're doing if it's working, but a lot of times the waste that we do have is out of sight, out of mind, and you might not really be aware of all the stuff that's going to waste in your home.
Talk about this. I have an aging refrigerator, and so I've been sort of saving up and scouting out, you know, the things that might be available. I also have a small house and a small kitchen. And I have very few choices available to me because most of the fridges that are sold in this country are gigantic.
Oh, tell me about it. That is a huge cause of waste where we feel the need to fill up our refrigerator, but they're so big these days that in order to fill it up, you basically buy more food than you could possibly eat. And I don't think I quite realized how big American fridges are until I went abroad and people wanted to talk about that. And interestingly enough, this is a few years ago, and they wanted to talk about Seinfeld and how Jerry's refrigerator was just massive. And to me, it was just a normal fridge.
Yeah.
So that was really eye-opening.
Yeah, and it does make sense that when you do that, then stuff gets pushed to the back of the shelves, and you don't see it, and you forgot you had it, and it goes bad.
Yeah, that's the old out-of-sight, out-of-mind problem. So what I advise there is when you get new things to put those in back and to push the older stuff to the front. And if you're not going to use it that day, then you should really just get rid of it or try and figure out a way to use it. And that's a real opportunity to be creative and look at recipes and try and find out ways to use up ingredients you might not otherwise know how. And with the Internet, there are so many websites out there where you can just type in an ingredient or two, and it'll spit out a recipe.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. You can put the two search terms in, and there's 18 recipes that put really bizarre things together, and usually they work okay.
Yeah, I think you'd do well, and it's almost like it's taken away another excuse for wasting food. So
1-800
will do well.
933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Bill in McKinney. Hey, Bill.
Hi, how's it going? This is a great topic.
Thanks.
I just recently moved down from New York City about a year ago, and I noticed that the plate sizes down here in Dallas especially are just much larger than what I was used to. And a local restaurant near me in Plano used to serve some very exquisite sort of small plates, but when they were unpopular, they had to switch to huge portion sizes. And I think the quality also took a dip as well.
Thanks for your call. Jonathan, you write about plates in the book.
I do. And certainly the caller is right that our plate sizes have just gone through the roof. And there's an anecdote. I don't know if it's legitimate or not, but I think it's illustrative in that there's a couple who was out at an antique fair, and they saw these dinner plates they wanted to buy. They asked the dealer, you know, how much for those plates, and he said, oh, well, those are actually serving plates. They're not dinner plates.
Hmm.
So the upshot of having these large plates is that we just have so many, we just put so much food on plates, and our portions have increased as well.
Well, that makes me think of the Brian Wansink research about, you know, people don't realize that they're overeating. You just eat a plateful of food or you eat a spoonful of something that you serve family style. And if you make that smaller, you don't really miss the food you're not eating.
Yeah, Brian Wansink's research is really interesting. His book, Mindless Eating, I'd definitely recommend. And yeah, he found that we eat to visual cues. So we want to say, let's say we're given a bowl of oatmeal, we want to eat maybe a third of it or two-thirds. But what he found was he did this incredibly mischievous study where he had these bowls of soup, and half the college students who were involved in the experiment, half of them had regular bowls, and the other half had these bowls that surreptitiously filled up by a tube underneath the table, so they could never make a dent in that soup. And I know many of you might think that's what happens every time you eat out at the Cheesecake Factory, try and make it through their salads. But this was actually happening in an experiment, and those students ate almost twice as much as the students who just had regular bowls.
Jonathan Bloom is my guest. His new book is called American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Jonathan Bloom. His new book is called American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Join us at 800-933-5372. Jonathan, is food just too cheap in this country?
Well, from one perspective, it is. I know that the people out there who are struggling to put food on their table will certainly disagree.
Yeah.
But when you look at food as a relationship of our income, it's tremendously cheap. So our household spending is about 10% of it goes to food. And not only is that at historic lows, but there's no other nation in the world that spends as little on food. So I think the result of that is that we don't tend to value food as much as we could.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Grandview and speak with Pam. Hello, Pam.
Good afternoon. I had two comments. One, the caller Tim earlier talking about a sharing fee when two people have one entree at a restaurant. I felt like that had more to do with the relationship to tipping, because tipping the server is based on the amount of money you spend on the food rather than number of people served. And so I could see why they would be very unhappy if you bought $10 of food instead of $20 of food, because it would cut their tipping in half. And then on the wasting of food at home, we've developed the habit over the decades, years, that we don't waste food at home. If we don't eat it, one of our animals will eat it, or it goes into the compost and eventually becomes food for the soil to grow new food in our garden.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thanks for your call, Pam. It is interesting. My grandmother used to use her dog as a sort of garbage disposal if there was something that no people would eat anymore. And we don't do that with our pets now. And a lot of people will say it'll kill your animals to eat table scraps.
I think I'm one of the people who tends to give a little more food to my dog. But there's an EPA hierarchy of sort of the uses for food, and on top of that list would be feeding people, but right underneath that would be feeding animals. And traditionally, it's more livestock, mostly pigs, but also there's some other applications there. And I think composting would probably be a better choice than feeding your dog, but I do that as well. So guilty as charged, I guess.
Talk about composting, because, you know, people think that it's going to be messy and smelly and it's going to attract insects and rodents, and it's actually not that complicated at all.
No, it's not too tricky. I mean, basically, you have to get out of the way. You sort of set it up and let nature run its course. And there are a few tips. Like, most people shouldn't put dairy or meat in their compost piles because they're not going to get their piles hot enough to deal with that. But for the people at home who are a little intimidated by it, I would definitely say it's not tricky. You can compost your fruit and vegetable scraps and the foods you don't eat fairly easily. You just get a bin, maybe an Earth Machine is a popular brand. And as long as you have a little space outside, you should be okay.
Yeah, you can actually do it with like a Rubbermaid garbage can and, you know, drill some holes into it, and that works pretty well too.
Yeah, there are many DIY solutions out there. So I think if you get online and read about it for a little bit, you'd do pretty well.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Nancy in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. This is a great topic.
Thanks.
I had a quick plug and a question. My quick plug is for the Gleaning Network of Texas, which is a nonprofit here in Dallas that redistributes food like from farms, directly from farms or from vegetable brokers, and redistributes that food out to food banks, which is prevents waste. Mm-hmm. But my question is, I ran a donation garden growing food strictly for charity, and I go around to grocery stores and ask them if I could have their old rotten produce to put in my compost pile, and I'm always told, no, it's against corporate policy, we can't allow that. And I ask them and say, you know, I could be here on a regular time. I would be a faithful picker-upper of the vegetables. I would, or, you know, I can go dumpster dive. And they never, they never tell me why. They won't let me have their rotten stuff that they're going to throw away, but they absolutely obstruct my ability to get it. And I just wondered why.
That's a shame. What do you know about stuff like that, Jonathan?
Well, I would guess that they're not giving you that food because they're afraid that you might try and eat it, and that they are afraid of you getting sick from it. But on the other hand, what that points to is landfill prices being incredibly cheap. You'd think that they'd want to get that really heavy stuff out of their waste stream, but there isn't all that much incentive for that because it just doesn't cost that much to send it all away to the dump.
What happens to food that ends up in landfills?
Well, when food decomposes anaerobically, it emits methane, which is a greenhouse gas that's more than 20 times as potent a heat trapper as CO2. So we're basically aiding climate change when we throw food away. So that's why I mentioned earlier in the show that I try and avoid that at all costs. And when you compost, you avoid that situation because it's decomposing aerobically. As long as you stir your compost a little, every once in a while.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Jenny in Dallas. Hey, Jenny.
Hi. My question has to do with the expiration dates on food. How much should we trust the date on packaging? And because it seems to me like we err on the side of caution on that. And if there is actually some kind of an expiration time, where should we go for that authority if it's not the actual box?
Well, I definitely would advise looking at those dates with some skepticism. There's a whole lot of caution built into them, and that's primarily because there's a real fear of lawsuits. So I don't have a specific place to send you to give you a decent guide, but what I would advise is that a good rule of thumb is about a week past the expiration date, and my team of lawyers would advise me to say that's just a ballpark estimate. But the ultimate authority should be your sense of smell or sense of taste. And you know, I think that you or other folks out there will be able to tell when something's not good.
There are also things, particularly produce items, that may not be good. You know, you might not want to slice up a tomato and eat it if it's gone soft, but it's perfectly fine and safe for making sauce out of.
Yeah, and yeah, when we're cooking things, there tends to be a little more leeway. And I know there are some recipes that put sour milk to use. So that points to a little bit the loss of food waste that we've seen in this country. And a lot of people aren't really getting those tricks of the trade passed down from one generation to generation as we have kind of left the kitchen, and mostly as a result of our busy lifestyles.
Are we better off shopping more often for smaller quantities?
Well, it really depends on your lifestyle and what works for you. That's how I tend to approach things, but many people don't like going to the supermarket, and so they just want to kind of get in and grab things for the week and get out of there. So if you're going to do that, I would advise to plan out your meals really carefully and then make a detailed shopping list so that you don't get into the store and just buy all this food and you don't know what you're going to do with it, but you'll figure it out later. Well, what tends to happen is you figure out 2 weeks later that you didn't use it.
Yeah, you say it's also important to kind of be honest with yourself about the amount of cooking that you do.
Yeah, I think that's really important. A lot of folks think that they're going to cook these fresh, healthy meals, and we all have a decent sense on what we should be eating these days, or at least what we shouldn't be eating, which is, you know, fast food and takeout and that kind of thing. Once in a while is fine, but so we get into the store and we buy all those fresh foods, but then when we get into the work week, we're so busy, a lot of us, that we don't have time to cook that food.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Andy in Dallas. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This kind of goes back to the grocery store scenario. So I visit Whole Foods on a regular basis, and they have a lot of prepackaged fruits and fish that the actual grocery store cuts up and puts out on the shelf. And I tend to have a busy day and visit the grocery store late at night, and I see these shelves that are just packed with fruit and vegetables and all prepackaged food that they've made. And I'm thinking to myself, surely this stuff isn't going to stay on the shelf that long because it's not perishable. So my question is, are there any sort of programs that grocery stores could get involved with in order to maybe take that food to a homeless shelter or a food bank of some kind? I mean, I've never heard of a grocery store donating all the leftover food that they ultimately throw away and waste.
What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, there are many food recovery organizations out there, and one of the callers mentioned the Gleaning Network of Dallas, and they would traditionally work more on the farm level, but they might get involved here, and there might be more of a traditional food recovery group in Dallas. I'm not exactly sure. But, yeah, that's part of what they do is go to these supermarkets and collect what stores have that's edible but not sellable. So at that point, it's a lot of stores do give some of their foods. It's just a question of what they give. So as we mentioned before, you know, the bread and stuff is a dime a dozen almost, because stores produce so much of it, but those fruits and fish, you don't see donated too much because they're just a little afraid of the liability, but certainly can be donated if you create a strong relationship with the nonprofit in the store.
Has it always been possible to walk into a grocery store at, say, 9:15 at night, and if you expect a rotisserie chicken, find six of them roasting on a spit?
Not exactly.
You know what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah, definitely. You didn't used to be able to get rotisserie chickens at a supermarket. That has come to be almost mandatory, and that really happened in the 80s when that fad kind of hit. But the whole idea of prepared foods in the store has reached this critical mass where it's almost as if you're going to a restaurant. And if you're going to do that, then you kind of have to have it available at all times. And in order to do that, there's a tremendous amount that gets culled or thrown out. So when you talk about those chickens, it's usually about 4 hours that they'll have them sitting out. And after that point, a lot of stores just toss them. And some of the more shrewd stores will make chicken salad out of it or something like that. But there isn't too much repurposing in the food industry, in the supermarket industry, that is, because that takes labor and know-how.
Let's go back. We have time to take one more call from Gordon in Burleson. Hi, Gordon.
Hello. I have a comment. I was at a school a long time ago, I think it was a school, where one meal that served some things, and then people commented the next meal, some of those appeared in the soup, so it looked like they were using leftovers in the soup. And then I'd say another possible use for leftovers would be to feed it to the hogs. Then later you could eat the hogs.
There you go. You kind of keep the food chain going.
Right.
Yeah, it does seem, Jonathan, like these things that were so familiar to us generations ago now seem like these great new ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the book kind of looking back at how we used to handle our food. And what we could do today is certainly nothing new. It's just paying attention and having uses for repurposing that food. So whether it's putting tonight's chicken into tomorrow's chicken soup or composting the leftovers or feeding them to livestock, for those few folks out there who still have livestock, there are a number of options, and putting it into the landfill should be the last option.
Let me ask you this. Do you have kids?
I do. I have a son.
Is he picky?
I'm pretty fortunate. He's a decent eater. He's almost 2 years old now, but it's definitely a challenge. There's some waste that happens whenever he has a meal, but I try not to serve him too much at one time. That's my one strategy for trying to reduce waste is not giving him too much food in one sitting, and he can always ask for more. But that drives home the point that there is always going to be some food waste, and I don't think that we'll ever reach the point where we don't waste any food, but we can certainly do a whole lot better.
Jonathan Bloom is a journalist who also blogs at wastedfood.com. His new book is called American Wasteland: How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. Jonathan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.